to further tighten our budget. Instead, he said, "It's time to hire a babysitter." What? What are you talking about? Of all the things I thought he might suggest that we needed to do in response to this news, that was pretty much the last thing I would have guessed. With what money? We have that money we put away toward a better minivan. We can use that. I stopped. Joe, this is crazy talk. We have to have a new car. Our car works. It gets us from place to place. We'd managed to get the driver's side door fixed, which undoubtedly disappointed the neighbors who were enjoying the free entertainment of me climbing in and out of the window, but it still had a whole host of other problems. "Hey, banana!" a neighborhood dad yelled from across the street. Joe held up his fist in a man-to-man gesture of camaraderie and strength. "Also, this current minivan will be totally maxed out when this baby gets here," I pointed out. "It only seats 7. We'd barely have room for groceries or luggage or anything else." We resumed walking to follow my parents and the kids. "Look, yes, I agree that if we could go shake a money tree in the backyard and then buy whatever we wanted, we should get a newer car and a bigger house and a babysitter. And maybe an extra banana suit as well. But we can't. And so we have to prioritize. And I really think that getting help for you is more important than those other things." Joe had an expression for situations like this, and it was one of my favorites. Life isn't about having it all, but about being good at not having it all. I tended to drift from one want or need to another without pausing to ask if there was actually something we wanted or needed even more that would be a better use of our limited resources. Joe's business school background had trained him to prioritize ruthlessly, even when it meant making unexpected choices, like this one. "I'm not saying a car or house upgrade isn't important. I think those things are really important, actually. I'm just saying that you having some help with the kids is more important." I was appreciative, but a little perplexed. "So I get to stay home with the kids and not bring in an income and still have household help? I thought only the women from Real Housewives did that." I had justified the temporary hire of Terry and a couple of other sitters over the years because I was at least attempting to make money at those times. I still planned to get back to work with writing, but my expectations about income were much humbler this time around. Therefore, I had assumed that childcare help would not be part of my life anytime soon. Think about what Yaya and Papa were saying when Lucy was a baby, about how unnatural your life is in modern suburbia, Joe said. Never in human history have parents raised kids in isolation. Never. People always had their clans or their villages or their tribes or whatever to help them. Kids ran around with other kids. People lived in multi-generational houses where grandmothers or nieces or cousins would be around to hold a baby or help cook. Or, like Papa and Yaya, they roamed around their farmland all day. When my mom was a kid, she and her siblings and friends ran around for hours without their parents even knowing where they were, I said, starting to see where Joe was going with this. "Hey, banana man! Banana!" Joe did his solidarity fist to more men walking in the mellow sunset light with their mermaids and wizards. Then he turned back to me. "Before the modern age, you simply don't see people even trying to raise children all on their own. You see them sharing the work with their villages. And so hiring a babysitter replaces the village?" "Exactly. People didn't used to have grocery bills because there were animals around to hunt. Grocery expenses are a natural part of modern life to compensate for the fact that we can't walk outside and spear the nearest animal for dinner. The neighbors might not appreciate that. And that's how I've come to think of childcare. It's an expense like groceries. People didn't used to need to spend that money, but now they do. It's something that's worth trying really hard to fit into the budget if there's any way you can, because it's something you were designed to need, but you don't have in your natural environment." It occurred to me that there were other ways to ease stay-at-home parents' burdens as well. I'd seen people move out to land where their children could safely escape the confines of the house for hours at a time. Here in suburban Texas, families often bought spacious homes where the kids could wander between multiple playrooms to keep themselves amused without their moms playing entertainment director. And all of the options achieved the same effect: relieving at-home parents from the pressures that come from the highly unnatural situation of having their children all up in their faces all day, every day. The kids came rushing back from their latest stop, screeching in delight that these folks gave out full-sized candy bars. It was getting dark, so we paused our conversation to keep our crew closer together. A large mass of people moved toward us, and as our group mixed with theirs, the scene looked like something a comic book creator had come up with while high. I heard someone on the other side of the group whisper, "Dude, I think that banana is my lawyer." Chapter 23. Family Meeting. I sat in the parked car so long that the windows were now fogged over. "Mom, are we going in?" Donald asked from the back seat. I checked the time on my phone. I'd procrastinated so long that we were about to be late. "Yes, okay, we're leaving now. Grab your backpack." We walked across the gravel parking lot in the cold November air, both of us stuffing our hands into our jacket pockets for warmth. I was here to drop Donald off at school and to tell the administrators that we were withdrawing him to homeschool. When we'd gotten the letter informing us that he was accepted into this charter school, we'd been elated. When we took his kindergarten first day of school picture, all his clothes bright and clean, it was comfortingly familiar. Joe and I both went to public schools, and so it felt like we were sending our own kids off into a system we knew how to navigate. Even when the first problems arose, we tried to ignore them. Every night, Donald came home with over an hour of homework, almost all of it busy work that reviewed concepts the class had already mastered. We told ourselves that that's just how schools do things these days. A few weeks into the semester, the workload increased further. "I just played with blocks and ate applesauce when I went to kindergarten," Joe exclaimed in exasperation as he sifted through the latest stack of assignments. On top of that, the school was a 20-minute drive from our house with no bus service, and the commute was starting to wear on everyone. The problem was that we couldn't find a better option. Our local elementary school wasn't a good fit for different reasons, and we couldn't afford Catholic or other private school. At one point, Joe brought up homeschooling. I laughed, but it was a forced laugh because something felt right about it. The more we looked into it, the more it made sense. There were endless options for online schools and classes where we could connect with great teachers from all over the country. The customization of the curricula and the flexibility of schedule worked well for the family vision we were crafting. Yet even as I grew increasingly excited about this possibility, I didn't view it as a perfect solution that would make all of our problems disappear. I had come to see that there are no magic bullets when it comes to making these kinds of lifestyle choices. The name of the game is to take an honest look at the pros and cons of each option and then figure out which one your family is best equipped to deal with. For us, for now, that was homeschooling. I nervously stepped into the front office of the school, which was decked in brown and yellow streamers in anticipation of Thanksgiving. The administrator was working to fasten a cardboard cutout of a turkey to the wall when I asked if I could get the withdrawal paperwork. I'd spent my whole life so immersed in the traditional school system that this move felt dangerous and illicit, like I was here to announce that I was kidnapping my child. I'd prepared a convoluted speech about why we'd made this decision, but I didn't need it. The administrator paused her work on the turkey to grab a thin stack of forms from a file and wished us well as she slid them across the desk. That night, after Kate went to bed, we called a family meeting. For the first time, we would bring them into the discussion that began under the elm tree at the Tex-Mex restaurant. The kids were only now at ages where we could begin to have these kinds of discussions. Donald had just turned 6, Lane was 4, Lucy was 3, and Kate was 1.5. Even the big kids were still a little young to grasp it all. When we asked them to name 3 adjectives that describe our ideal family culture, we got answers like princess and ice cream. We set our standards low for the conversation, our only goal this time around to initiate the concept of these sorts of family talks and to tell the kids about some recent decisions we made. We had already talked to Donald in detail about homeschooling, so now we informed the girls. Lucy wandered off to play with the dollhouse. Lane reported that Jarman, her imaginary friend, said he liked the idea. We took that as an indication of assent. Then we told them about my book plan. I was going to rewrite the manuscript with a goal of finishing the whole thing within 18 months. the sting of Ted's rejection of the first draft had faded, and not just because of the passage of time. Seeing my own work as just one part of our family symphony helped keep my ego in check. I mean, I still wanted to collapse dramatically onto a fainting couch every time I thought of the moment I learned that I was facing a full rewrite, but now I had a bigger vision into which I could channel that angst. And so we explained some of this in very basic details to Donald and Lane, with Lucy half-listening from over at the dollhouse. For the first time, I brought them into my love of writing. My face was bright and hopeful as I talked about how this work filled me with energy. I told them about Ted's rejection, and they gasped as if I were recounting a fireside ghost story with a flashlight under my chin. I explained in my perkiest voice that we should see those kinds of setbacks as opportunities, not failures. I avoided looking at Joe during that part, since I knew he'd be laughing at the irony of me delivering that particular nugget of wisdom. The kids were giddy. A little bit of healthy pressure always brings fresh energy into a house, and they were elated to be part of such a crazy, risky endeavor. Donald promised to say extra special prayers for me. Lucy kissed my hands to bring them good luck while I was writing. Lane gave me her special cross bracelet that had magic powers because the Easter Bunny blessed it on Good Friday, which filled me with gratitude and a desire to pay extra attention to our homeschool theology curriculum. When I looked at their faces arrayed around the table, so innocent and open and willing to go along with whatever crazy idea their parents concocted, I felt like I might explode with love for these little people. Chapter 24, A Beautiful Home. It was time to hire a babysitter. We'd had that discussion about the importance of help almost a month before during our trick-or-treating walk, and I hadn't taken any action. When Joe would ask about the holdup, I had a new excuse every time. "Why haven't you hired a babysitter, Jen?" he'd ask. "We can't afford it." "We made that whole spreadsheet about how cutting back on groceries and a few other expenses will make it work." "If we're going to have someone here for the long term, there are probably tax implications, and who knows how to figure that out?"
"I do."
"Well, I doubt there's anyone out there who'd want to watch this number of kids for the hourly rate we could pay."
"Have you looked?"
"It's more of an intuition." After one such go-round, Joe finally interrupted and said, "I don't get it. When we worked together, you seemed to thrive when you had a complicated problem fall into your lap. You took it as an opportunity to innovate. Yet now, when you're in the same situation at home, you seem paralyzed." I opened my mouth to argue, but shut it when I realized he was right. If I were working at a company and had to hire an assistant on a small budget for a difficult job, I would have brought my A game to the task. I would have unearthed previously hidden resources, found a unique angle to attack the problem, and ultimately completed a seemingly impossible job. Yet now that I had a similar conundrum in my home, I was flailing around like a helpless damsel who'd never faced a hurdle in her life. It didn't take much analysis to see what was at the root of it. Fear. This time around, we weren't looking for a temporary sitter. We were hoping to find someone who could come 2 or 3 afternoons per week over the long term. But what if I ended up not clicking with her and everything was awkward? What if she was as revolted by our lifestyle as Terry, the babysitter of doom? What if she didn't supervise the kids the right way? What if this really was a self-indulgent expense? A nun once told me that her number one rule in life was, never make decisions out of fear. That advice had never steered me in the wrong direction, and yet I was completely ignoring it here. And so I set out to rediscover my energy for solving tricky problems. I felt like a superhero who'd pulled her uniform out of a pile in the corner of her closet, snapped it in the air a couple of times to smooth out the wrinkles, and donned it once again. That version of me who had the burning will to smash past obstacles had been missing for a very long time. Now, she was back. First of all, I brainstormed with Joe about where I could hire someone who would be a cultural fit, as we said back in the tech world. In other words, someone who wouldn't look like that guy in the Scream painting when she saw that we had almost half a dozen young children in this house. I had just joined a homeschooling list which had many large families as members, and I realized some of them might have older children who were looking for babysitting work. I posted a job offer there. To make up for a low hourly rate, I offered a flexible schedule and limited the responsibilities to childcare only. No extensive cleaning, laundry, or errand running would be necessary. I also added that the person was welcome to catch up on schoolwork or read, text friends, or whatever, if the kids were asleep or having quiet time. The other thing I could offer was a bonus internship. I would happily share what I knew about writing or the tech industry, and this person could put it on her resume and use me as a professional reference. After a short interview process, I hired a 17-year-old young woman named Monica, who was the oldest of seven children. She would come 3 afternoons per week. When she arrived for her first day on the job, Kate answered the door wearing only a diaper, with Lucy giggling behind her. Lane was having a Barbie doll party in the living room, but we'd lost their clothes long before, so all the Barbies were naked. One of them didn't have a head. Donald was overtired and had gotten frustrated by a video game, so he slammed the remote control on the ground just as we walked into the living room. I took her on a tour of the house, peppering my explanations with commentary like, "I don't know why that shoe is hanging there," and, "Is that an apple under the TV stand?" Then we reached the top of the stairs. It must have been my habit to pause right there to point to the 3 bedrooms, because we ended up standing exactly where Terry and I had stood on her first tour. I was in the middle of a rambling excuse for why all the rooms were so messy when Monica's face lit up in a warm, generous smile. "Mrs. Fulweiler," she said, "you have a beautiful home." Monica was working out wonderfully. Not only was I back to work on the book, but I'd been offered a paid blogging gig with a newspaper called the National Catholic Register, which most people referred to in shorthand as the Register. It was a popular publication in my circles, and my inbox was flooded with notes of congratulations when they made the public announcement that I was joining the team. The pay was not huge. It didn't even come close to being a 4-figure monthly income, but the work was pleasant. I could do it on my own schedule, and it helped me build an audience, which would be important for when Ted started to talk to publishers about my book. As the weather grew cooler and fall turned into winter, I felt my first big crunch. I was making great progress on the book rewrite. Then, the Register asked me to put together a few extra pieces for a special occasion. Meanwhile, Monica was out of town with her family, and I was struggling to keep our homeschool organized. In the midst of all of this, a ministry commitment rolled around. I generally didn't volunteer for any extra activities. I'd even reached a level of maturity where I could simply say, "I can't take on any additional commitments right now," rather than pretending not to see emails or faking illness like I used to. But I had signed up for a group at our parish that took turns cooking for our pastor and his associates, who worked day and night to serve the thousands of families who attended our church. I only had to provide a night's worth of meals once every 6 weeks, so it seemed like a reasonable commitment. I actually looked forward to giving back in this small way. This time, it wasn't working. As my week to cook drew nearer and my stress level grew higher, an idea kept coming to mind. What if I asked Papa if he wanted to do it this time? I kept talking myself out of it on the grounds that I didn't want to burden him. But the thought wouldn't go away. I had learned a lot of lessons about asking for help in recent years, starting with the time that Hallie came over and ended up dealing with the poopocalypse, and more recently, my experience with Monica. Combined with Father George's insights about letting go of individualistic thinking, I was starting to see that being completely self-sufficient wasn't necessarily a virtue. In fact, my constant insistence on being able to handle everything on my own with no assistance from anyone was usually rooted in pride more than anything else. So I called Papa and explained the deal. I was in the middle of saying "no pressure at all" for the third time when Papa interrupted. "Jenny, would you let me do this?" he asked in his quiet, sincere voice. "I would need about a week to get it all together. But if you have that time, I would love to do this very much. very, very much. When I went to pick up the dishes from him a week later, he had pushed himself to the very limit of his energy. He was sitting in a chair in the kitchen when I arrived, and I knew he was worn out when he didn't stand to greet me, an unthinkable gesture to a man of his generation. My dad was coming to stay with him the next day as part of his now weekly visits, and he wouldn't be arriving a moment too soon. And yet, Papaw's face shone with the happiness of a much younger man as he explained each of the dishes. The Cornish game hen roulade would be best reheated in an oven at 350 degrees, he said slowly but with great confidence, leaning forward onto his wooden cane. The vegetable soup is already in my freezer from last month. I hope the Padres don't mind. I assured him that they wouldn't, noticing how he referred to the priests with casual familiarity, calling them Padres. Though my grandfather was a lifelong Methodist, he had had a lot of exposure to Catholicism in his years in Mexico and South America. He'd always had positive interactions with the priests and considered it an honor to be asked to cook for them. For the apple crisps, I made a graham cracker crust from scratch, he added, pointing to the foil-covered ramekins on the counter. I looked through my favorite dessert recipes and thought they might like that one the best. I learned about that crust from one of those French chefs on TV. It's really something else. As I packed up the various dishes into the canvas cooler bag I'd brought with me, Papa said again, "Thank you for letting me help." Something in his voice reminded me of the last interaction I'd had with Monica before she'd gone on vacation. She seemed almost worried that this job might not be here when she got back. On her way out the door, she paused to thank me for hiring her. I was so caught off guard that I wasn't sure how to respond. Before I could speak, she explained that she was trying desperately to save up for her own car, but it was hard to find work that would fit into her school schedule. She said that she had been praying every day for weeks for an opportunity like this one. "Thank you for being my answered prayer," she said. She began to walk to her car, then stopped. She turned around and wrapped me in a hug. Those words echoed in my memory as I looked at Papa, who exuded joy through his weakened physical frame. I told him how much this would mean to the priests. They'd be dining on frozen pizza tonight if it weren't for his efforts. And I also told him how much it meant to me. He seemed so moved that I thought I saw tears in his eyes. "I can't tell you," he said, then paused for a moment before he finished. "I can't tell you how much it means to me to feel needed again." Chapter 25. Advent Rock. Advent had begun, Christmas was just a few weeks away, and I was ready to win this holiday season. Granted, special occasions had led to some of my most spectacular failures as a homemaker, like the time our gingerbread house turned into a gingerbread condemned building. It looked so terrible that the kids wrote graffiti on the walls and icing to complete the motif. But I was floating around on a high of optimism since everything had been going so well lately. After seeing pictures all over the internet of elegant houses dripping in seasonally appropriate decorations, I had great visions of what we might be able to do this year. My creative juices were flowing when Joe returned from the attic and plopped down a beat-up cardboard box on the kitchen table. Its label said, "Advent stuff." The words scrawled above crossed-out labels like "Halloween inflatable ghost" and "Blow-up Easter bunny," a sad homage to the various seasonal decorations that had met unfortunate ends in the Fulweiler house. I was enough of a realist to know that there would be no handmade wreaths adorning the front door, no garland gracefully draped around the fireplace. A lot of people I followed on social media got an elf on the shelf and pretended that he scurried around and made mischief while everyone slept. I skipped that one, too, for reasons that were explained well by a commenter on my blog who said, "The creators of this thing obviously never saw Poltergeist." But one decoration I knew we could handle was our Advent wreath, a simple tabletop circle of greenery containing four candles. I pulled back a flap of the box, eager to add this lovely holiday piece to our home. Joe reached in to grab the candlesticks, and out came the most pitiful sight I'd ever seen. And an important lesson that one should not store wax objects in one's attic if one lives in Texas. The summer heat had withered the long candles to the point that they were almost unrecognizable. The wax had seeped down upon itself like sagging skin, and the once regally straight shafts now drooped over like misshapen L's. In an unfortunate moment of man-think, Joe declared cheerfully, "They're a little melted, but they'll still work." He grabbed a match and lit one of the purple ones. We stood there for a long moment, him looking from the burning, lumpy mess to me, realizing that this demonstration was not having the desired effect. He blew out the candle and tried a different approach. "We can use the white candles in the pantry. It doesn't really matter if they're purple and pink. The colors are supposed to symbolize sacrifice and penance. Any decorations we put up in this house are an exercise in sacrifice and penance." Again, I didn't even answer. Finally, he said the right thing. "I'm going to go set up the advent calendar. You handle this however you want." I pulled the wreath from the box to find that it had also not done well in the furnace of our attic. The plastic pine needles were matted and bent, with hardened drips of wax caked throughout. I pushed the bedraggled candles into the holder at the center of the wreath, hoping to make the best of it, but it was too pathetic. I huffed over to the pantry and replaced them with the white ones, silently lamenting that this wasn't even a real Advent anymore. The Christ child's appearance on earth had been rendered meaningless by the incorrect pigmentation of my candles. Joe returned from setting out the wooden calendar and nodded approvingly at our attempt at a seasonal wreath. "See, those candles look great," he said. Then he added, "We can't light them, of course." I began to object, but then I remembered last year when I turned my back on the fourth Sunday of Advent to see that all of the newly lit candles had been yanked from the wreath and were now being wielded by various toddlers, like the beginning of a very strange fire breather act. That evening, I tried to salvage the first day of Advent by reading a seasonal book with the kids. As soon as I announced this idea, I was overcome with the usual sense of doom that befell me any time I contemplated reading with young children. I'd seen the studies about how kids whose parents read to them would all grow up to be nuclear scientist humanitarians, and how kids whose parents didn't read to them would be lucky if they could spell their panhandling signs correctly. Joe and I both read incessantly. I was building an entire career around the written word, for goodness sakes. But reading books to multiple young children was, to me, the type of activity that always made me feel like I'd lost a bet. Nobody could ever agree on what book to read. After the nightly battles over which title would be our story of choice, new arguments would erupt about who sat where. Then there would be arguments about who would turn the page. Then someone would get bored of the story halfway through and demand a new one, and factions would develop over whether to stick with this book or switch to a different one. This night was no exception, and it ended symbolically with Kate throwing a book about God's mercy against the wall. The next day, I called Hallie to rehash everything. She and her family had ended up moving out of state, and now they lived in Alabama. The move had had surprisingly little impact on our friendship. With so many young children, she now had five, we found it almost impossible to get together even when we lived in the same place. Now we talked on the phone at least once a day. I noted, only half-jokingly, that if she hadn't told me they moved, it probably would have taken me a few months to notice. When she answered the phone this time, I didn't even let her speak before I launched into a rant. I pointed out that basically all traditional holiday items are breakable, flammable, traditionally stored within reach of small children, or all of the above. "Evidently, we cannot handle this kind of thing in our house, so it's time for some new traditions around here," I declared. "You know what we're getting next year? An Advent rock." I laid out a vision of a holiday tradition that the Fulwilers could actually deal with. As Christmas time approaches, families will prepare by getting out a rock. This rock symbolizes the strength of God, or the stability of the church, or something. The Advent rock would be stored in a titanium cage and hung from the ceiling. Hey, the cage could symbolize God's care of us, and hanging it up high could symbolize our desire to be closer to heaven, Hallie said, the first words she'd been able to speak in this conversation. I think my family needs one of those, too. I sighed into the phone. We'd just finished lunch, and the kids were playing at their sand table outside. I popped a half-eaten chicken nugget into my mouth, then spit it out when I tasted that it was soggy. I didn't even want to think about why it might be waterlogged. Okay, but seriously, I worry that my kids will look back at their childhoods and feel like they got short shrift. This always happens this time of year. Maybe God was calling me to have lots of cats, not kids, and I misunderstood. Just because your first day of Advent didn't go perfectly? Hallie, it was beyond a little imperfect. These candles were just melted blobs. And we couldn't even finish the story about God's mercy before I started threatening everyone for fighting over the book. I explained that I'd come a long way toward accepting the unique way that we do things as a family, but there was still something missing. Maybe you need to find a way to be a great mother, but also to be you, Hallie said. Did you get that from Dr. Phil? I think it was Pinterest. But seriously, have you ever thought about the unique things that you can offer your kids that other people couldn't? If they've ever hoped to see someone sit in a silent room and stare at their computer, they are so lucky to have me as a mom. Seriously. I was about to make another joke, but then an idea popped into my head. Hey, wait, what about electric candles? What? I couldn't tell if Hallie was asking for clarification because her children were making whooping noises in the background and she didn't hear me, or because she had expected another sarcastic comment. Okay, maybe the Advent rock isn't the final solution. But what if I just did battery-powered candles instead of the real ones? Oh, I love that. I just saw some electric tea lights at a Christmas party, and I had no idea they weren't real until someone pointed it out. It seemed like an insignificant idea. But for me, it was an epiphany. That night, I went online and found plastic votive candle holders in the traditional pink and purple Advent hues. The plastic was so strong and clear that it looked exactly like glass. Nobody would know the difference until one got thrown across the room and it didn't shatter into 1,000 pieces. I added a package of battery-powered tea lights to the cart and placed my order. When they arrived 2 days later, I cleared off the table. Right in the center, I sat down 2 purple candle holders, then a pink one for Gaudete Sunday, then a final purple one. I switched on 4 electric candles and dropped each one into place. I remembered that we'd found a green placemat in our Advent stuff box. I'd been planning to toss it, but now I retrieved it and slid it under the candles. I stepped back to behold my table. The votive holders looked even more elegant than I'd expected them to. Their exteriors gleamed like polished crystal, and the green placemat evoked the image of a wreath. The tiny lights danced erratically inside, as if whipped around by an imperceptible breeze. One day, I would have a gorgeous Advent wreath with real candles whose flames sent light wisps of smoke floating up toward the ceiling. But right now, this would have to do. And in fact, I couldn't imagine anything more beautiful. That night, I started to read another book with the kids, but it degenerated in all the predictable ways. We were at the part where little people were yanking books around dangerously close to my face when I called a stop. Obviously, I was missing whatever skill other mothers had to make this activity pleasant and not dangerous. But surely there was something I could do here. I did love words. I did love stories. And so I made an announcement. Guys, put the book away. We're doing something different tonight. We're having a dance party? 3-year-old Lucy asked hopefully. Let's do karate. Donald jumped up and gave the air a firm chop with his hand. No. No dance parties, no karate. But if you guys will all get in bed, we'll turn out the lights and I'll tell you a special story that's created just for you. The kids cheered at such an exotic idea. Donald rushed back to his top bunk. Lucy settled into her spot below and Lane snuggled under the covers on her bed across the room. Kate needed my help climbing into Lucy's bed, where she sat up in eager anticipation of her special tale. And you guys get to name the characters, too. First of all, there's a princess. What's her name? Arancella, Lane shouted. A fight almost broke out over Lucy and Donald having different suggestions, and it occurred to me that I'd have to let them all name someone. Lucy, this princess has a dog. What's his name?
Peapie.
Peapie? Okay. Donald, give me another name.
Zoranzo.
Wow, you guys are very creative. And Kate, do you want to name the kitty?
Cat.
These are excellent names, guys. Okay, here we go. Once upon a time. I set the scene for the life of Her Royal Highness Arancella, a spunky princess from a magical kingdom. The ideas flooded in, one after another. Arancella was on a journey. Her dog, Peapie, had been stolen. Her cat, Cat, wanted to help her find him. Christmas imagery floated before me, and I decided that she was following some sort of sign in the sky. Instead of a star, it would be a little glowing fairy named Zoranzo. For years, I had thought of my overactive imagination as a defect in my personality. It was my tendency to live in my head that left me twitching and running to check email when I saw a mess on the kitchen table, that made me have to remind myself to hug the people I loved instead of just ruminating silently on their positive qualities. Now, for the first time in years, it felt like a gift. This world that I brought my children into was magical and real. My mind was so alive with possibilities that the only challenge was cutting down the options to form a coherent story arc. I leaned forward to whisper key parts, then leapt up and waved my hands as I described the great battle where Princess Arancella and Cat summoned their courage to fight the wicked witch who'd stolen Peapie. When I brought the story in for its dramatic conclusion, the kids exploded into cheers and applause. Chapter 26. Resistance. Joe had taken the kids on a homeschooling field trip, which gave me some much-needed time to catch up on the book one morning. Just as I began a new chapter, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a silver minivan ease to a stop in front of our house. My hands dropped from the keyboard, and I began smoothing and pulling at my clothes self-consciously. My visitor was a woman named Christy, and she ran the meal ministry that cooked for the priests. It was my turn to cook again, and Papa wasn't feeling up to it this time, so I was on my own to get everything taken care of. When she heard I was nearing the third trimester of pregnancy, she offered to pick up the food from me and take it to the church. After all of my recent lessons about accepting help, I silenced the protest that bubbled up within me and simply said, "That would be wonderful. Thank you so much." The women in our parish spoke of Christy with awe and deference, as she was known to possess more parenting and household skills than all of us put together. She was the one whose children were always immaculately dressed and perfectly behaved in church. Other moms whispered that they'd seen the inside of her minivan, and it was as clean as if she'd just driven it off the lot. There were legends that she could do glitter crafts with her children without screaming even once. I had always avoided her, not out of dislike, but because I knew I'd feel inferior in her presence. As I watched Christy and her three children walking up the stone path through my front yard, hurrying toward the door to get out of the January air, I remembered that I didn't even have the food ready for her. I'd been so focused on my book that I had forgotten completely. "Hey," I said when I opened the door, my voice trilling up so high that it broke. I cleared my throat and continued in a normal tone. "Hey, come on in." She greeted me warmly, each of her children looking me in the eye and offering appropriate greetings. Her short-cropped blonde hair was sleek and styled, and her white wool pants inexplicably did not have a single stain on them. Christy's kids got to work exploring the toy options in the living room, occasionally exchanging perplexed glances when they picked up one toy after another whose batteries were dead. A messy pot of chili simmered on the stove with mismatched Tupperware containers strewn across the countertop nearby. I'm so sorry I didn't have this together. It'll take me just a sec here, I said. The truth was that I felt like my brain was going to melt and I had no idea where to start. Why don't you sit down, honey? Christy said. You're pregnant. Let me get all of this together. I gratefully accepted her offer, watching in awe as she glided from one task to the next. She moved about my kitchen as if she'd lived here for years, quickly locating a ladle to stir the chili, whisking the cornbread out of the oven at just the right time. While she was dumping the salad into a gallon plastic bag, she said, "My sister sent me a link to that article you wrote for the Register the other day. I saw what you said about how all women, even women staying at home with kids, need to have an outlet to use their talents." I'd been enjoying taking all of my ruminations on those subjects and posting them online, but I wasn't prepared to discuss them in person, especially with this supermom who likely disagreed with me. "Oh, I could be off base with that stuff. I don't know," I said. I hoped to make it clear that my comments weren't meant to be judgmental of her own life choices. "I really respect women for whom motherhood is enough, like you. It probably says something bad about me that I always have to run off and stare at my computer." "No, Jennifer, that's what I loved about it," she said. She'd had her back to me as she worked at the stove, but now she set aside the food and turned around. "People see that I like to keep my home super clean, and I love getting the kiddos all dressed up. They hold me up like I'm doing all of this out of some really strong sense of duty. But let me tell you, that is my thing that I love to do. What was the term you used for it?" "Blue flame." "Yes, that's it. Before I had kids, I was an interior decorator. Style, beauty, all that stuff. It's my blue flame. I'm using my gifts just like you are." "Wow, I'd never thought of that before." She returned to her work with the food, and I let her words sink in. Christy was using her blue flame, too. It just looked different because her gifts had a natural outlet in household work. I used to think there was a rare, special group of superwomen who could do nothing but serve their children and their families 24/7, who never yearned to use their God-given talents. Now I wondered if perhaps every thriving mother pursues her personal passions. I thought of the woman in the bookstore coffee shop who'd triggered such insecurity in me years before because she was spending time with her daughter while I was blogging. Maybe she was doing work that she loved as well. Maybe she had a passion for education and felt alive when she browsed the children's reading section. Maybe she was no more or less dedicated to her children than I was to mine. And maybe I could have gotten to know more women like this over the years and learned a few things from them if I hadn't thrown up walls between us out of a misguided sense of inferiority. Progress on the book was good, yet I was surprised by how difficult almost every single writing session was. I'd sit down in front of the blank page, brimming with inspiration. Then I'd type a few sentences and think, "This is the stupidest thing anyone has ever written." I'd see a blog post by a writer whose talent far exceeded mine, and I'd decide that I should give up on the written word altogether, perhaps not even attempting to jot down the grocery store list anymore. Social media would lure me away with the siren song of new updates and funny jokes, and I'd find entire writing sessions gone before I even realized what was happening. If this were something I was meant to do, shouldn't it be easy? Or at least easier than this? I wondered if this was a warning sign that I was doing something wrong. I referenced this latest round of writer drama on my blog, and one of my regular commenters asked if she could send me a book. I went ahead and gave her my home address, figuring that if she were a stalker who planned to show up at my house, I could actually use an extra pair of hands around here. A package arrived at the end of the week. I ripped it open and pulled out a small, thin book called The War of Art. I glanced at the first page just as I put a pan of fish sticks in the oven for lunch. 20 pages later, the smoke detector let me know that the food was done about 10 minutes ago. I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning finishing the book that night, then reread most of it again the next day. It read like a guerrilla warfare manual for anyone who's ever tried to follow their dreams. It was one long battle cry for us to get off our couches and start fearlessly putting our work out into the world. The book led me to a variety of aha moments, but there was one part in particular that changed the way I saw the world. Its author, Stephen Pressfield, put a name to the phenomenon of resistance. Though Pressfield was not writing from a strictly religious standpoint, he elucidated the workings of an insidious force he'd encountered over and over again in his work as a screenwriter and best-selling author. He spoke of this malevolent entity that hates creation and wants only destruction. Resistance is that temptation that leads you to sit back and criticize others instead of following your own life's calling. It's the lost running shoes and malfunctioning alarms that make it so hard to start that new workout routine. It's the fights that break out among well-meaning people in a powerful ministry at church. It's the force that has stopped countless artists throughout the ages, repelling them from their work like two similarly charged magnets. Resistance obstructs movement only from a lower sphere to a higher, Pressfield wrote. It kicks in when we seek to pursue a calling in the arts, launch an innovative enterprise, or evolve to a higher station morally, ethically, or spiritually. I recognized this force of which he spoke. Early in my conversion process, one of the things I found most fascinating about the Bible was all the talk about evil and demons. Jesus himself regularly spoke of dark forces working in the world, and it seemed pretty clear that he wasn't speaking symbolically. I would have thought this sounded absolutely insane only 10 years before, but I had come to know with certainty that these forces do exist and do operate in the world. Pressfield called it resistance, though it has been known in Judeo-Christian tradition for millennia. We might have different nomenclature, but we all agree it's real and it's powerful. And now that I thought about it, I had been pushed back by this force constantly in my struggles to create in any area of my life, both with my work and with my family. You can't follow that call to have more children. You're already failing so miserably. Why bother writing this book when so many other people are so much better at this than you are? You need to give up if you can't adhere to a perfect schedule. Everyone will laugh at you if you put yourself out there. With a jolt, I realized that these were the whispers of resistance. And as with all effective lies, they contained a grain of truth. I wasn't the best. There were real issues to manage in terms of being a good mother to my children. There were plenty of areas of life I needed to improve. But the dark tone of these feelings that moved through me like a tsunami, leveling any hope or excitement in its path, that was a hallmark of resistance. It made perfect sense that women would be particularly susceptible to this force. Archbishop Fulton Sheen once commented that the history of civilization could actually be written in terms of the measure of its women. Women have always brought critical insights to their culture's public dialogue when their voices were allowed to be heard. And women who are close to vulnerable life, by being around children or taking care of the elderly or working with those in need, have critically important perspectives. They have a unique glimpse into the human experience that the world desperately needs to hear. So of course resistance would want to keep them hidden and silent. With all of these thoughts still lighting up my mind like fireworks, the next week I got a call from Hallie. "Have you heard about Anne?" she asked, referring to my Canadian blogger friend. Her voice brimmed with excitement as if she had big news to deliver. "I know her book came out a couple of weeks ago. Is there something else?" "Jen, her book is blowing up. I mean, it's everywhere. It's all over the bestseller lists, in the media. Everyone is talking about it." "Seriously?" I gasped. I was standing next to my laptop in its usual place on top of the fireplace. I dashed out a search. The first thing that came up was the New York Times bestseller list. And sure enough, There was the name of the humble farmer's wife, who had no idea how she was going to write a book. My brain raced as I attempted to process what I was seeing on the screen, like if I were trying to understand a complicated puzzle. Listed among some of the most famous people in the world, I saw the name of my friend and her book, 1,000 Gifts by Anne Voskamp. Wow, I whispered to myself. I was so astonished I'd almost forgotten I was on the phone. I heard about it because I ran into a neighbor this morning who brought it up out of the blue, Hallie said. She didn't know I'd even heard of Anne. She kept going on and on about the book, saying I had to read it, that she couldn't explain the impact it had on her life. She actually started crying. When Hallie and I got off the phone, I dashed off an email of congratulations to Anne. I let out a laugh of disbelief when I remembered her worries that nobody would want to hear what she had to say, that her words might not be good enough. I thought of all of the fears she'd had to face down. I thought of the endless guilt and hesitation that so many of us wrestled with as we pioneered this new age of raising children in the internet era, when we had unprecedented opportunities to share our gifts with the world. As I stood there, a shocking thought came to mind. I tried to dismiss it as an overstatement, but it kept ringing in my soul. Maybe resistance is trying to stop women from changing the world. Chapter 27. Decibel. The baby was born at the end of June, our fourth daughter in a row, named Pamela. We were pretty sure that Donald had now accepted it as a biennial tradition that mom and dad went to the hospital and brought home a baby girl. I had dared to imagine that my experience with this baby might look something even a little bit like our experience with Kate. I pictured another daughter who would spend the first year of her life sleeping and quietly smiling at us. If I had only taken a moment to picture the exact opposite of that, I would have had a clearer vision of how things were going to go with our fifth child. Pammy was what parenting experts delicately call a high needs baby. She cried when I picked her up, when I put her down, when I offered her food, when I didn't offer her food. Any of these scenarios could be occasions of extreme distress for her that would launch her into screaming stretches that lasted for 5 to 10 minutes at a time, and felt like they lasted hours. I mentioned this on the blog and was flooded with endless suggestions, and I tried them all. Baby wearing, elimination diets for nursing, allergy testing, co-sleeping, no possible baby-soothing stone was left unturned. By the time Pammy was 9 months old, I was convinced that she was the loudest, most screamingest baby in the world, as well as in the entire history of the world, and in any extraterrestrial worlds we have yet to discover. When nothing was bothering her, she was perfectly cheerful. But the minute she had to face a tragedy, like having her shoes put on or being offered food she didn't like, she'd lose it. Determined to quantify my suffering so that I might assist others in pitying me, I bought a decibel meter to prove that this child had a special gift in the lungs department. When the big kids saw it come out of the box, they wanted to play with it to see how loudly they could make noises. Feeling like a pro parent, I closed the garage door and told them to go have some educational fun with it in there. What I had not considered, however, is that there is no way to make a very loud noise that is also a happy noise. Donald, Lane, Lucy, and Kate took turns nearly blowing out their vocal cords, ripping out shrieking terror screams fit for a sequel in the Saw franchise, occasionally pausing to giggle. It was the time of the evening when many neighbors were out for walks, and I could only imagine what they must have thought when they passed the Fulweiler garage of horrors. When we finally tried the thing out with Pammy, the opportunity arising when my arms gave out after holding her up for 9 consecutive minutes while she played with a light switch, we found that her screams reached 115 decibels. Joe noted that she was violating workplace safety standards, and according to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, she was required to provide us with protective ear coverings. When I detailed this and everything else to the pediatrician, he just laughed and suggested that we nickname her Decibel, which was not helpful. In the midst of this, my progress on the book remained steady. The months were full of distractions and setbacks and always getting a little less work done than I wanted to, but I pressed on as I was able. And then, on a hot August afternoon, I finished the book. Monica was playing Play-Doh with the kids in the kitchen, and I typed the final words with the sounds of children's laughter and plastic cans clunking on the table in the background. That last page symbolized so much. So many years of dreaming, so many battles fought. I leaned forward to gaze at it, giving myself the space simply to soak in the magnitude of this accomplishment. And then I remembered that Ted could always make me rewrite it again, which took a lot out of the moment. I used up the last of a cartridge of black ink to print the draft for Joe, and at the end of the week, he returned it with his feedback. It was a hallmark of our relationship that Joe and I were always direct with one another, and never was this more true than with his edits. He had plenty of encouraging complimentary things to say. All over the manuscript, there were notes like, "Wow," and "This scene is great, so powerful." And then there were marriage testing sentences like, "Dragging a bit." Well, actually, this chapter drags a lot. Next to a paragraph that I had found particularly poignant was a scrawled sentence, "No one cares." A comment that I thought was rather witty, if I did say so myself, elicited the note, "Is this supposed to be a joke? So weird." There was a chapter that I had imagined would move my reader to profound emotion with its eloquence, and I noticed that there were no comments from Joe in the margins of its pages, presumably because he was using his writing hand to wipe the tears from his eyes. Then I got to the end and saw his note at the bottom. "This whole chapter makes you seem insane." It took me almost a week to incorporate his feedback, and then I sent it to Ted. The moment I clicked the send button, I experienced a disorienting mix of hope and dread, excitement and foreboding. On the one hand, I was confident that this was a solid draft. On the other hand, I'd thought that before. Maybe I'd been thrust into a Groundhog Day alternate universe in which I would spend all of eternity writing and rewriting this same book. Ted replied in only 2 days. He said he wanted to talk on the phone again. Once again, I observed that saying, "It's fine," does not require a phone call. Since I needed to work within our babysitting schedule, I arranged the call for the next afternoon. It was only 24 hours away, but it felt like 24 days. While I waited, all the moments that led up to this phone call flashed through my mind. Ted's surprise reply to my email just after I'd found out I was pregnant with Kate. The neighbor girls playing ding-dong ditch. Throwing the binder with the ill-fated first draft on Hallie's sidewalk with the kids throwing up in the back seat. Ted telling me the first draft was garbage while Barney sang, "If You're Happy and You Know It." And even before that, there were all of my dreams of writing a book. I remembered sitting with my dad, our chairs pulled up in front of the TRS-80 computer, breaking down the plot lines of our latest stories. I thought of all those times I'd come home from another long day of being the awkward new kid at school, when I'd drop my backpack by the front door and bound upstairs to the computer. My face would exude carefree happiness, often for the first time all day, as I typed a story that might help someone else escape from their own troubles. For the call with Ted, I sat behind my desk. Usually I would have locked myself away in my bedroom, or even the closet, depending on where the household noise level was that day. This time, I stayed in my home office downstairs, as if Ted would be able to sense how professional I looked and find himself unable to reject a manuscript by such an imposing figure. My cell phone buzzed on the desk next to me. My stomach felt like I was on an elevator that had just lurched into a free fall. I answered the phone. My entire body was rigid as I forced casual chit-chat to begin the conversation. Then he said, I read the manuscript. And? In the millisecond that passed before he answered, I closed my eyes and steeled myself for his pronouncement on the word.